Live from the Benedict Music Tent, an afternoon of conversation. You're listening to Aspen Public Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is David Bradley, and this is Peter Thiel, who's here with me. This is going to be the least obvious way to start, but I want you to know that I have three sons. They're fine men. They're perfectly fine men. But this is the son I intended to have. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to summarize his life in 1 minute, and then you tell me if that isn't the report card you wished your children had brought home. So here's Peter Thiel in a minute. Born in 1967, so let me do the math for you. He's 47 years old, turning 48. The family followed his father's career. So born in Germany, goes to the United States, goes to Africa, comes back to the United States. In the United States, he's educated in California. He went to 7 elementary schools. He started chess at age 6. By 12, he was number 7 in the country in chess. He scored
in the under 12 category.
Under 12 category. I was older, and I was playing him, and I did quite well, actually. Then he went to Stanford, majored in philosophy, Stanford Law School, clerked a little bit, did a little law, did a little bit of finance. Then he co-founded PayPal. He sold to eBay, making him, by Silicon Valley standards, a meaningless, barely bankable $50 million. Peter was 30 years old then. At 36, he became the first outside investor in Facebook. So let me put the question to you. It's 2004. Facebook has been around for just a few months. It has effectively zero revenues, and Peter is offered the chance to buy 10% of Facebook for $500,000. Would you do that? He did it. It was a $1 billion gain within a decade. He remains on the board of Facebook. Started a hedge fund, started a venture capital fund, went on to become the co-founder of Palantir. Peter has an argument, I don't know whether we're going to have time to get to it or not, that he could reasonably, many people now could reasonably expect to live to 120 years. So let's just pause it for a moment. He's halfway through his life. When you read the literature, when you talk to his friends, what do you hear about him? These are the three things that I heard. Number one, fiercely intelligent. That's the chess, math, Stanford part. Number two, a public intellectual. He writes and speaks on government authority, moral legitimacy of higher education, the problem with elites, the rise of machine intelligence. The billionaire Silicon Valley investor Marc Andreessen said, and I'm quoting, "It's hard to be around Peter and not think I have to get smarter. When it comes to philosophy, history, politics, the fate of humanity, Peter has up-leveled the discussion a lot." What a lovely phrase, up-leveled the discussion. And number three, he's known as being the great talent master of Silicon Valley. So he founded PayPal, and then his PayPal alums have gone on to found their own companies, LinkedIn, Tesla, SpaceX, YouTube, Yelp, Yammer, 20 other companies, market cap value of over $30 billion. This PayPal progeny, the alumni who have gone on, are called the PayPal Mafia, and Peter is called their dean. So let me revisit the starting question. Who wouldn't want to claim Peter as his son? This is going to be a little awkward here on the stage for a moment. You might want to find something to do. Peter, how would you feel about calling me Dad?
I feel pretty awkward about it, actually. But this is like this sort of introduction. It's all going to go downhill from here. This is like really, really, you're setting a bar unbelievably high for me.
And that concludes our time together.
You're
Thank
really
you for coming.
Dad.
So let's humanize Peter, see if we can get him to answer a little bit of a personal question, then we'll go to their larger issues. The run I just gave is too full of success. There must have been some complexity about being thought of as a child prodigy or having that kind of attention focused on you. Talk about whatever that complexity was, and then tell the Supreme Court story.
Well, there's a way in which I grew up in a phenomenally tracked context at the end of the day. You know, in California, eighth grade, junior high school, one of my friends wrote in my yearbook, you know, I know you make it into Stanford 4 years later. 4 years later, you go to Stanford. Then 4 years after that, Stanford Law School. Probably the final sort of tracked credential that I thought I needed to get was a Supreme Court clerkship. Got interviews with 2 justices. They normally interview 8 people, pick 4. I missed it with both. At that point, I was just absolutely devastated. One of my friends who had helped coach me through the process, years later, we reconnected, and he sort of asked, You didn't have to ask me, you know, how are you doing, or it's great talking to you, Peter. First question was, so aren't you glad you didn't get that Supreme Court clerkship? And there was sort of the sense, more generally, that in my 20s there was a super track thing. You know, I ended up at a top law firm in Manhattan. It was one of these places where from the outside everybody wanted to get in, on the inside everybody wanted to get out. When I left after 7 months and 3 days, one of the people down the hall from me said, you know, it was really reassuring to see that it was possible to escape from Alcatraz. And actually, all you had to do was go out the front door and not come back. So it was a little bit easier than Alcatraz. But it was difficult because psychologically, so many of our identities get wrapped up in these competitions we win. And I think often the people who are in our society who are very talented, very gifted, in some ways get tracked into this even more intensely than elsewhere. And I think we all, you know, if we're going to build a better future, we need to do new things, and we can't all do the same tried and true things that have worked. And so I always try to get at these things indirectly. So it's, you know, what great business is nobody building? The interview question I always like to ask is, tell me something that's true that very few people agree with you on. Somehow, how do we break the mold? How do we move out of it? And these are super hard questions for people to answer, even when they can read on the internet that you're going to ask the question of everybody who comes in the door. It's one of those questions that doesn't actually become easier when you know that it's going to be asked, because even though we all have some answers to these questions, they're very uncomfortable, because in the context of an interview or anywhere else, the answer is one that the person asking the question doesn't want to hear. If they agree with you, it's probably a bad answer, you know. And so I do think this challenge from breaking from convention, being able to do new things, is a very acute one. You know, already in the time of Shakespeare, the word ape meant both primate and to imitate. There's something about human nature that's very deeply imitative. It's how kids learn language from their parents. It's how culture is transmitted in our society. But then there also are all these contexts where imitation goes badly wrong. It's the madness of crowds, it's market bubbles, it's all sorts of crazed manias that we've seen in recent decades. And so, you know, you have this very strange phenomenon in Silicon Valley where a number of the more successful people seem to be suffering from a mild form of Asperger's. And I think we always need to flip this around into an indictment of our broader society, and we need to ask the question, what is it about our society where those of us who do not suffer from Asperger's are talked out of our interesting, creative, innovative ideas before they're even fully formed, where we sort of pick up on all these cues from the people around us and notice, oh, that's a little too weird, that's too strange, I better just stick with that Supreme Court clerkship.
Peter, you have some evolving views on higher education. There's some wonderful quotes. We have a bovine attitude towards academic degrees. Higher education is the next U.S. bubble. University administrators are subprime mortgage brokers, as if they were subprime mortgage brokers. Explain the argument.
Well, education is it is sort of seen as the absolute be-all and end-all, as the safe way to track things. And education is very good at training people to do the same things that we've done over and over again. It's perhaps not as good at pushing some of these newer ideas. I think there are a whole set of challenges that have gone wrong. It's the costs have escalated faster than inflation since 1980, faster than any other category. And then there are all sorts of questions whether the kind of incredible tracking, where you know, kids are getting tracked already in preschool, certainly K through 12, is in some ways narrowing things and sort of socializing our younger people in ways that are less good than they appear. You know, I think there's always a question what the nature of the educational good is. You know, you can say it's an investment good, we're investing in the future. You can say it's a consumption good, like college is a 4-year party. You know, I think most of the parents and students think of it actually as an insurance policy, where you're buying this really ever more expensive insurance so that the students don't fall through the really big cracks in our society, and we should be asking some big questions why the insurance costs are going up and up like that. And I think that reflects some questions about our society. But then I think from the point of view of the colleges, it's not an insurance policy at all, but it's sort of a crazy tournament. And it's a zero-sum tournament. And if you were the president of Harvard or Stanford, if you wanted to get a lynch mob of students, alumni, faculty to come after you and try to lynch you, what you should say is something like this. You know, we live in this much larger, more global world. We offer great education to everybody, and so we're going to double or triple our enrollment over the next 15 to 20 years. And people would, they'd all be furious, because the value of the degrees comes from this massive exclusion, and what you're really running is something like a Studio 54 nightclub with this incredibly long line outside and a very small number of people let inside. And it's branded as positive sum, everybody can learn, and the reality is deeply zero sum.
Peter and I had time to talk by phone last week. It was just a phone call. It wasn't that special, frankly. But thank you. So Peter and I had time to talk last week, and I said, so what's the big thing you're thinking about? What's the big thing you're talking about? And he said something contrarian. He said he's not overwhelmed by the pace of technological progress. Used words like stagnation, Groundhog Day. Flesh that argument out a little.
Well, I think one of the very important public policy questions in our society is how much technological progress is happening, because I think this is what's going to determine whether the quality of life is going to get better for people in our society in the decades ahead. And you know, I'm not absolutely negative, but I'm probably slightly on the pessimistic end of the spectrum as Silicon Valley goes, which I think is always hyper optimistic on this question. And I think it's been, if we look at the past 40 years, it's been the story of quite rapid progress in computers, software, internet, mobile internet, in the world of bits. It's been much more limited progress in the world of atoms, whether it's energy, you know, biotech has been more challenging. There have been more challenges in everything from transportation, you know, space travel, all these things that people would have called technology in the 1950s and 60s, I would say have been much slower. So there's been a lot of progress in the world of bits, which have been quite unregulated, a lot less progress in the world of atoms, which for all sorts of reasons, both good and bad, have been much more heavily regulated. And I think the upshot is that when you look at things like the productivity growth numbers in the economy, the GDP growth rate, these things are actually somehow slower. And then we have all sorts of complicated debates whether these numbers don't measure things correctly. I think they're, you know, roughly correct, or they're no more distorted than they were 40 or 50 years ago. And so I think we have to take very seriously this idea that perhaps there's not as much progress as there has been in the past.
It's what decade was the golden age?
You know, I think that in the 50s and 60s you had very rapid progress, but I think you would have had rapid innovation even in the 30s, which were, you know, horrible decade by almost every standard. From the point of view of technology, you had phenomenal progress. You had secondary oil recovery, you had the plastics revolution, household appliances, the movie industry, the aviation industry. So if you looked at all the new industries that were started in the 1930s and you contrast that, say, with the 2010s, it tells you that this is an era that's actually much worse than the 30s from the point of view of, say, technological innovation. So I think we had a lot more for maybe the 150 years before, and you could pick any decade like that.
You have a now famous quote about flying cars.
Well, it's probably been overdone, but it's basically that they promised us flying cars, and all we got was 140 characters, which And it's always I think it always gets misread as a bit too much of a negative thing on Twitter, because I think we have had a lot of very successful companies in Silicon Valley, and Twitter is a, you know, phenomenally valuable business. It came up with a new way to narrowcast communication. But of course, there's a sense that even though it can be great as a business, it's great for the 2,000 or 3,000 people who work at Twitter. They will have well-paying jobs for decades to come. There is a sense that level of innovation is perhaps not enough to single-handedly take our civilization to the next level. And so I think we have a lot of stories of specific success, but they don't necessarily translate into this general societal improvement.
Peter published a book, wrote a book in 2014, which was a bestseller. It's called Zero to One. I read it. It is astonishingly original, and it's just taken by storm all the young entrepreneur community. He was teaching a course at Stanford in 2012, and one of his students, Blake Masters, took notes and put his notes up online. They became a little bit of a sensation in Silicon Valley, and then David Brooks wrote a column about it, and they ended up with 2.4 million page views on his notes. So he and his student wrote the book. Give the argument of the book.
Well, the contrast I try to start with is two different modes of innovation or progress. And I think we can have progress in the 21st century through globalization, where you copy things that work. It's going from one to end. China is the prototype of that. And there are ways in which that's worked incredibly well. And we can debate, you know, how well that's going to keep working from here on out. And then there is, and I always draw that on an x-axis and describe that as horizontal or extensive progress. And then there's doing new things, so copying things that work, globalization, and doing new things, that's technology. It's going from zero to one. So it's going from one to 100 typewriters, going from a typewriter to the first word processor. That's sort of vertical or intensive progress. And the basic argument is that those are the kinds of businesses we need to be building more of. If you succeed in building them, they can be very valuable because, on the inside, you often don't want to be copying things that work because you end up with super competitive businesses. You don't want to necessarily be starting the 20th pet food company, online pet food company, or the 1,000th restaurant in San Francisco, which is sort of my example of what was a bad business to go into. So copying things that work is not always the best idea in business, but actually trying to do new things can often be both good for innovation and good for business. And you have to try to get that intersection just right.
Many of us have children who have decided they want to be entrepreneurs, and you see them by the raft. What's your observation about what young, smart people are doing? Are they headed down a right path, or do you find it disappointing?
Well, it's hard to generalize in such broad brushstrokes. I'm always a little bit nervous of people who say, I want to be an entrepreneur. So I think that's roughly in the same category of, I want to be rich, I want to be famous. You don't start a company or start a new business for the sake of starting a business. Ideally, you start a business because there's a very important problem that cannot be solved in an existing, large government, large corporate, large nonprofit structure. Why do you ever start new businesses? It's because large structures get too sclerotic, too political. They can't actually do new things, it should always be anchored in some specific substantive problem which you're going to solve. I never like the abstraction of starting a business for its own sake.
George Packer wrote a profile of you in the New Yorker. I think we can all agree that it was a disappointment to him that the magazine was The New Yorker. But we at The Atlantic take a broad view of this, and we think within another 100 years, they're going to really make something of themselves there. So George Packer said, here I'm quoting, he might be the most successful technology investor in the world. In Zero to One, there's a 7-part test that Peter applies to investments that are brought to him. What I thought we might do is just go through a few parts of that test so you get a sense of the rigor he's bringing. The field that we're going to talk about for a moment is green technology, where Peter is a little bit of a contrarian in the community of people who are enthusiastic about it. So let's see how green technology fares against elements of the test. So one is the question of monopoly. Could you explain the test and what your thought on green technology is?
If you're starting a company, you always want to aim for monopoly, you want to have a large share of a market. And so, paradoxically, it's often good if you start with small markets. If you go after small initial markets, and a lot of the, like eBay started with Pez dispensers, and then it went to Beanie Babies. And then it gradually expanded into collectibles, and so that was sort of a very interesting way to start a business. And they often start with markets that are paradoxically too small. This has been true for so many of the great internet companies. The clean tech startups—they all started. The first slide of every presentation was: we have a market. It's called energy. It's measured in trillions of dollars, and we're like this tiny minnow in a vast ocean. And you never want to be that. So whenever you have vast markets, that's telling you the competition is going to be too intense, too indifferent, undifferentiated. You're not going to be able to do something that's really interesting. And this was a very deep endemic problem to much of that field.
How does clean tech do against the test of durability?
A great company is not just the first mover, it's not just someone that does something new, but it's one that somehow will be a last mover, where it has some sort of a lasting advantage. There are many areas of clean tech innovation where it's been this sort of very small set of incremental improvements. So you come up with a new solar panel design, it's 10, 15% better than the next guy's, but then someone else comes along with a better design 1 or 2 years later, and you're out of business. So it's a good form of innovation for society, but it's paradoxically quite hard to get it to work on the business level. And there are many areas of innovation that have this sort of continuous feel to them, where it ends up being very difficult to get the business to work. Disk drive manufacturing in the 1980s, aviation, you know, it was great for society, hard to get the business models to work. And so one of the tests I often have is, can we do something where you get enough of a breakthrough and then you somehow are able to maintain that lead? And that's often been quite hard to get that story told.
And then there's an elegant test of the secret. Will you explain that?
Well, it's just some answer to the question. What do you believe that other people don't? And so if you if there are too many buzzwords in a presentation, that's always a worrisome sign. So in Silicon Valley, people are focused on educational software, healthcare IT software, probably overrated. SaaS enterprise software, very overrated. Big data, cloud computing, if you hear those words, you need to think fraud and run away as fast as you possibly can. And so if I gave you a startup that was a concatenation of buzzwords, we're building a mobile platform for SaaS businesses to bring big data to the cloud. My sort of pattern recognition is that the buzzwords, they're a tell, like in poker, that you're bluffing and that there's nothing undifferentiated. There's no secret that you know that nobody else does. And I think that certainly during the clean tech bubble in Silicon Valley, sort of, which was about 2005 to 2008, you had, again, this sort of concatenation of all the buzzwords. They all sounded undifferentiated. You could work really hard and try to go beneath the surface and try to figure out, okay, was this one a little bit different from this other one in some way? But on some level, the surface of things was the heart of things. And if you just saw this this litany of buzzwords, it was a good enough reason to be quite nervous.
Peter has an original view on the process of aging. He talks about people being too complacent about the inevitability of death. He talks about death as a problem to be solved. And he's done some funding, nonprofit funding in this area. On the phone, I tried to push Peter to say, so how long can we live? And he resisted the question. Let's give it one more run. So pretend we're coming in at the top 20% of outcomes. 50 years from now, how long might the species live? And 200 years from now, how long might the species live?
Well, I'm still going to refuse to answer that question, and it's because I don't agree with this is not the right way to think about the future. The future is not this thing that is out there that's set in stone. This is like the Ray Kurzweil, the singularity is near. We have these exponential curves of progress. You know, there's a longevity trajectory where life expectancy has been going up by about 2.5 years a decade. It's been a straight line for 150 years, so you could extrapolate that. But I think there's But I think it's never set in stone like that. And I think we should talk much more about, instead of the future, we should always talk about this question of human agency. What can we do to affect these problems and shape them? And I think on this question of aging generally, there are these deep forms of psychological denial or all these crazy psychological ways that we deal with it. And I think the combination that we have with aging is generally a combination of acceptance and denial. And acceptance is, we're all going to die. There's nothing we can do about it. Denial, it's not going to happen anytime soon, so I'm not going to think about it. And you can sort of think of acceptance as extreme pessimism, denial as extreme optimism, but they sort of always, extreme pessimism and extreme optimism always converge. Extreme pessimism tells you there's nothing you can do. Extreme optimism, there's nothing you need to do. And so it always sums up to doing nothing. And I think that the question about the future should never be one of extreme optimism or pessimism, where it's just going to be this way. It should always be mild optimism, mild pessimism. It's contingent. There's a lot we could do one way or another. And so on this question, if we work at it, I think we could make tremendous progress. We could cure cancer. We could cure Alzheimer's. We might find there might be some general things that cause aging. So it may not be just these organ failures of one sort or another. I think there's a lot of general progress we could make. The question has barely been tackled, but it's something we have to choose to work on.
Peter, you did have a figure that if we defeat disease, and then we die by the chance of accidents. What's the math look like there?
Well, if you solve the problem of aging altogether, that wouldn't necessarily make you immortal. You'd basically end up getting into a car crash or plane crash or something like that. You'd die after about 600 to 1,000 years, and so then those things would become much more serious, and people probably would be very nervous about driving cars.
I want to close on a memorable note. So Peter meets Mark Zuckerberg. He's 20 years old. Zuckerberg is 20 years old at the time. Peter gives him, I don't know figuratively or how it's done, but you give him $500,000, and then you have four words of advice. Do you remember them?
Something like, don't mess it up.
Want me to do it?
So something like, don't mess it up.
He's such a gentleman. So can we be agreed on this one point? What a marvelous job I've done raising this young man.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute.